ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Yeah, it just struck me the other day. I was thinking about sort of, you know, the hustle and the bustle of this time of year, Christmas, New Year's, everything in between, heading here and there. You might be on summer holidays. You might be trying to see family. You might still be working. There's a lot happening. And I'm a bit worried that a fairly significant date on our country's calendar is going under the radar a little bit. This New Year's Day, amongst, you know, sore heads from the night before and resolutions for the years to come, depending on whatever you get up to, Australia is celebrating a remarkable heritage birthday. The 1st of January, 2026, 125 years of Australia becoming a Commonwealth. The date when six British colonies united and became one nation. It is a pivotal moment in our history, one that we maybe aren't recognising as well as we could. And to tell us a bit more about it, as always, very keen to chat to Michael Adams, creator and host of the Forgotten Australia podcast. Michael, welcome back to Nightlife.
Nick, happy new year.
Happy new year soon. I'm really excited. Almost. Almost.
We're almost there.
125th birthday of Federated Australia, the last day of colonial Australia. Can you take us back to 1901, to the 1st of January?
I can do my best.
I mean, it's a New Year's Eve and a New Year's Day, I guess, unlike any before or since in the nation.
So you've got New Year's Eve, you've got New Year's Day, you've got a new century dawning and a new nation being born as an old colonial collection is bidden a farewell. So, yeah, an incredible sort of confluence of dates and times. The other thing about it is that Australia's federation on the 1st of January 1901 was filmed by the Salvation Army's Limelight Division. So this was the first time that a nation being born had been captured on film. And it wasn't just, you know, a few seconds. This was a multi-camera operation with, you know, a lot of footage being recorded. And you can still watch that. And it's recently been colorized as well. So really quite striking. It was party central, and it was in Sydney, much to the chagrin of Melbourne. They weren't happy that the Harbour City had gotten the honours. So Sydney had been swamped with visitors from all of the colonies and also from Great Britain and elsewhere. So the population was huge. Everyone had poured into the city. And of course, on the 31st of December 1900, they were going to have New Year's Eve. So the city streets were packed by, you know, nightfall. People partied all night. There was, you know, what was described as a vocal jamboree, lots of noise, you know, driving out the old year, welcoming in the new. It was so busy that publicans were saying, gentlemen, no time for mixed drinks. You know, you just took what you got and you sculled it. So there would have been a lot of very sort of sore heads the next day. But of course, New Year's Day was an even bigger event. This was the, you know, the inauguration of Federation. And the people would be, you know, who barely slept would be backing up to throng the city streets and then to party all night again. So it really was, you know, we're going to party like it's 1900, 1901.
So I had no idea about the filming, and that surprises me. I don't know why that wasn't a big part of schooling to learn about that.
I agree. It's, you know, it's fascinating footage. It's feature length. You know, the first Australian feature narrative film was the story of Ned Kelly in 1906, but the Federation was a long film. It wasn't a documentary because there wasn't really sort of narration or anything like that. It was pretty much actuality, just locked off cameras, filming the procession, filming the ceremony out at Centennial Park. So a really amazing document of this pivotal part of our history. Which was, you know, Australia being born, but of course we were still very, very British.
Very British. I was just going to say, nice to know that even back then Australia was obsessed with reality TV.
that's right.
Very British. It was the Scottish-born Earl of Hopetoun who was our first Governor General.
That's right. I mean, he was a British aristocrat born in Scotland. He'd been the governor of Victoria from 1889 to 1895, I think it was, gone back to England, not taken a particular interest in the Australian colonies, and then sort of been dobbed in to be GG. And his first job as GG would be to select the cabinet for the interim Australian government before the first federal elections were held in March. Though he had one job and he blew it. I mean, he came out here. he got here on the 15th of December. fair enough. He was sick. He was really sick. He had malaria. His wife, Lady Hopetoun, had typhoid. She'd actually had to stay in Colombo and was going to follow when she could. So he was feeling poorly. And he selected to be the first Prime Minister, the New South Wales Premier, Sir William Lyon. Now, he just was following protocol. New South Wales was, the biggest and most senior colony. So he'd choose New South Wales as leader. They'd done this in Canada. It had all worked out fine, except this time everyone went, hey, hang on, William Lyon, he was anti-federation. We all want Edmund Barton. So this was called the Hopetoun blunder. It was a great start. And on Christmas Eve, William Lyon resigned his commission, returned his commission. The Lord Hopetoun, still suffering from malaria or whatever it was, invited Mr. Barton along, and he said, yeah, I'll take it. He named his cabinet and then graciously included William Lyon. So, a week later, the Governor General was to be sworn in, the first Lord Hopetoun as our first Governor General. Lady Hopetoun had made it to Sydney, but she was still too sick, so she wouldn't be at his side. You've got to remember, of course, this is the end of December, start of January, sweltering hot, a lot of very, heavy official costuming and uniforms and so on. Everybody would have been sweating bullets, I'd say, especially, if you had malaria. So it was, not a great start for Lord Hopetoun, but he got on with it. And the ceremony would happen in Centennial Park, but that was preceded by a massive procession through Sydney. And that was what people had really turned out to see first.
So there was a real feeling of celebration, like people were really excited about this, the public.
Yes. That's a generalisation, but the answer is yes. We'll talk a little bit about the people who were probably less excited and who was excluded. But it was reported that 750,000 people lined the city streets. And the entire Australian population, white population, because Aboriginal people weren't counted then, was 3.75 million. So it was about 1 in 10. That's quite incredible when you consider everybody had to come by sort of rail or ship or foot. So there were 750,000 people lining the Sydney streets. This procession went for about 5.5 miles. It started in Farm Cove, bound for Centennial Park where the ceremony would be. And the procession was in reverse order. Now, there hadn't been a lot of processions that a lot of people had seen, so they probably didn't understand this. So the working class would have been absolutely stoked to see the miners, the shearers, the timber workers and other unionists out the front, and then it would have slowly twigged that they were the least important people in the official view. Then they watched the mayors from state capitals wandering past, state politicians, Supreme Court judges, then Mr. Barton and his cabinet, then came the military. And this is the thing to remember, that this was a very militaristic Birth of Australia procession and ceremony. There were 10,000 soldiers. There were Australian state troops, New Zealand troops, and then men from 6 British and 3 Indian regiments. And this was the most popular sort of part of the procession by far. Newspapers had printed full-page illustrated guides so you could, identify your household cavalry and your royal horse artillery and spot the difference between the 9th and 14th Bengal Lancers, for instance. I mean, all of this made sense because Australia had just over the past year committed soldiers to the Boer War, and we'd also sent soldiers to put down the Boxer Rebellion in China. So even though we were celebrating Australian nationhood, we were also doing it in a way that really reaffirmed our military commitment to, Great Britain. So, the procession was brought up by Lord Hopetoun because he was the most important person on the day. He was with his secretary and his doctor in his carriage. His wife wasn't there because she was too crook. He wasn't with any Australian because there was no Australian yet of rank to sit by his side. I mean, that was what this day was all about. The bulletin took a very sort of jaundiced view of him and of this, love of Britain. They said he looked so puny, so wan, and they sort of said it was as if the way he looked was representative of the British Empire. So people were celebrating, but not everybody. I mean, people like, white blokes, like those who ran the bulletin, were pretty sceptical about, our continued loyalty to Britain and dependence on Britain. Women were not in the procession except in a symbolic fashion. There'd be a woman up there as Britannia or so forth. And, of course, Indigenous Australians were not represented. So whether you sort of, celebrated, commiserated, or thought, it was a good start, but there was a lot still to do, really depended on who you were and where you were from. So, there'd been referenda in all of the colonies about Federation, And, you know, they'd won a majority for in each of the colonies, but there were still sizable numbers of people who were against. So I think it probably would have been a bit of a mixed view, although I'm saying if you were going to line the streets of Sydney in the heat, you probably were cheering it on. So 7,000 guests were invited to the ceremony, and there were 60,000 punters out there to watch the Governor-General sworn in, the Prime Minister sworn in, the Commonwealth of Australia proclaimed. And, you know, again, it was all very British. There was no Australian flag yet. The Union Jack was flown. They did sing Advance Australia Fair, but it wasn't the anthem. It wouldn't be until 1984. So it was all God Save the Queen. And with the ceremony done, then the party, bigger and better than the night before, could get underway in Sydney. And people really partied very, very hard.
Michael, we just do need to talk a bit about WA, because they resisted the idea of federation for quite a while, didn't they?
They did. WA was the last to sign on. So the British Parliament on the 5th of July 1900 passed the Act that was for the Australian Commonwealth. 4 days later, Queen Victoria gave her royal assent to it. And it was only 3 weeks after that that WA finally had its referendum and decided, yep, we're for it. And while there were modest majorities in the city and in Fremantle, it was really carried by the miners of the goldfields. In fact, in 1899, they'd actually directly petitioned Queen Victoria, the goldfields, to be separated from WA, to be sort of its own colony. So they were, you know, they were fully for federation. And this is probably because WA had gotten responsible self-government in 1890. You know, 5 minutes later, gold was discovered. The population in the next decade went from 50,000 to 200,000. And many of those people who came to WA went to the gold fields or went to sort of Perth and Fremantle and other cities, but they were from the eastern colonies. So the original WA inhabitants, the sand gropers, kind of viewed them with suspicion. And I think they kind of also thought that federation meant they'd be dictated to by the eastern states when, you know, they probably felt in their hearts, these more conservative types, that their loyalty belonged to Britain. But, you know, by end of July 1900, I think probably Queen Victoria giving it the thumbs up would have, you know, held a lot of sway. They'd voted also to join the federation. Of course, that wouldn't necessarily stick. In 1933, the people of WA actually voted to secede. It was the UK this time that said, uh-uh. So, you know, if it hadn't have been for that, WA would be its own nation.
Michael, you did mention, of course, the ascent of Queen Victoria, but how was all of this being received back in England by the monarchy?
Look, it's hard to really say. I mean, in official capacity, she was acting formally and constitutionally, giving royal assent to an act of parliament. I think she probably would have thought, you know, well, 50 years ago, I gave the colony of Victoria its own status, separate from New South Wales. So, you know, that worked out all right. This will probably work out okay too. I mean, they're all still loyal to us down there. But of course, Queen Victoria had been on the throne for nearly 60 years. So if she was thinking anything, it was probably, I can't wait to sign this thing and get back to bed. And in fact, she died 3 weeks later. Didn't have long to think about the nation of Australia. And of course, you know, her death was a bigger story than federation. So it was very gracious of her Madge not to pop her clogs actually on the day and, you know, give it a good 3 weeks. So I think overall she probably didn't have a very strong opinion one way or the other.
I've been just looking at the dates, and unless I've got myself completely backwards, I think 2026, 4th of July, that'll be when the United States are going to celebrate 250 years of their Declaration of Independence. Now, I know the plan there is going to be like a year-long celebration, odd stuff, the Patriot Games, and I think there might be a special triumphal arch being built as well. But how are we as Australia going to be celebrating our milestone? Are we doing anything at all, and have I just missed all the announcements?
Look, I haven't seen Mr. Albanese announce an athletics carnival, a triumphal arch, or even a UFC cage match on the lawn at Canberra yet, at least. I mean, there's still time. We haven't actually started 2026. Maybe he's holding it back. Look, I think our sort of remembrances and commemorations will be a little bit more modest, and I, for one, am glad of that. I think, you know, there will be reflections such as, you know, the Australian Army was established in March of 1901. you know, in the wake of Federation. So that they're celebrating their 125th anniversary. You know, the same month, however, we also will remember that, you know, it's 125 years since the White Australia policy was enacted by this new federal government. So I think it's, you know, it's good to certainly to mark these occasions as a way to sort of reflect on our past and try and understand it better, which I think really helps us to understand where we are now and where we're going perhaps. So I do hope that we do sort of remember it. You know, I don't think we need a triumphal arch, but that's just me.
That is just you. Michael, we talk about this all night, but we'd better leave it there. And thank you so much for coming back and sharing some of your incredible knowledge on nightlife.
My absolute pleasure. You have a good 2026.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.